into the existing structure. And then I found I really had to go through, because the structure had developed over a couple of sections of sessions, 85, 87, I had to go through and reconcile some inconsistencies in the existing law so that all the language used and the definitional provisions worked together. And that's what really generated the bulk and the bill. It's been reviewed extensively. It all hangs together. It all works. It still imposes a significantly harsher penalty on those who are directly involved at the commercial level in the production and distribution of this stuff. Let me say one thing. I did intend, as I indicated to Mr. Kent before this hearing, to lean on him on the constitutional issue, because he's certainly spent more effort than I on the constitutional question. The first case in Oregon in which the Oregon Supreme Court took the line that we decide free expression cases first on the Oregon Constitution and only secondarily on the federal Constitution is Darris versus Myers. Nobody stands in front of me when it comes to supporting the concept of freedom of expression within the state of Oregon, and you're going to find a few people who have devoted more time to that project. But if we support the concept of freedom of expression, if it's going to survive, we have to recognize that there are some situations where it doesn't work. The most obvious is the fellow standing in front of you saying, "Give me your money or I'm going to shoot you." Sure, he's flapping his lips. He's expressing himself. He's using speech, but we all know that isn't protected. And there are a significant series of principles involved in distinguishing unprotected expression from protected expression. The Oregon Supreme Court in State versus Henry, in addition to the language cited by Mr. Kent, acknowledging that it was not deciding that question, said some things that I think go very far in deciding the question as to whether legislation like this is constitutional under the state statute. It referred to the benchmark tests, one of the benchmark tests that it uses, which is whether activities of this kind were prohibited when the Oregon Constitution was adopted in 1858. And if you look at page 522 of the decision, it distinguishes the case that the state had relied on there, or the statute that the state had relied on there, which involved protecting youth. The statute there was a general obscenity statute. It wasn't within that historically protected area of protecting youth in the state of Oregon. I think we have strong authority. I'm quite satisfied that the Oregon Supreme Court would uphold this legislation when enacted by the Oregon legislature.
Thank you, Mr. Darris. And I would point out, I don't know whether it's fair to draw any conclusions from this or not. I've been trying to get this answer for the last week, but I would point out for the members of the committee that there is no one from any civil liberties organization signed up in opposition to this bill, which is may or may not be significant. If it's deliberate, then it certainly is significant.
Incidentally, I have prepared and provided to the staff a detailed analysis of the statute.
And we have that in our possession. Let me ask you, we need to be brief because we have a number of witnesses signed up on this and other bills, but let me ask you one other question for either Mr. Kent, Representative Mannix, for anybody on the panel there. There are a number of exceptions written into the bill that I think is important for the committee to understand so that we don't have unintended consequences to this bill. And I wonder if one of you could just run us through those exceptions very briefly.
And again, my memo does cover those. Those sections are really a rewrite of that section 3 is really a rewrite of the existing section which I repealed, which is 685, I believe, simply because I couldn't understand it when I read it. It had grown over a couple of legislative sessions and didn't make any sense anymore the way it was written. The first exception, the broadest exception, is for medical providers. Medical providers deal with the body. And believe it or not, I hate to confess this, but after my second draft of this bill, I realized I had made it illegal for my wife to show me how to use a rectal thermometer. And having had to learn that with two children, the definition of explicit sexual conduct involving a child was actually changed to clarify the exception for medical diagnosis and treatment and ordinary hygiene practices. In addition, we have a very broad exception for medical practices. Physicians, after all, deal with the human body as in many. I had a good friend years ago, Bob Fisher, an ophthalmologist who called himself an eyeball mechanic. And they deal with the human body in ways that we don't have to, and as long as it's a bona fide medical process under the control of a licensed professional, I don't think the statute has to touch it at all. Law enforcement, we didn't give them quite as strong an exclusion. For bona fide law enforcement activities, they still can't go out and produce the stuff for a sting operation. We don't think as a society, and that's the way the existing law is, we don't think as a society we have to stoop that low in order to prosecute these cases. Educational activities in the fields of medicine, psychotherapy, sociology, and criminology, again, exempted, subject to the same exception. They can use the materials in their work. They just can't use children to produce it. Finally, the existing statutory exemption for sexual offender treatment programs is carried forward. Frankly, I don't know how those programs function, but I gather from existing law that they must need this kind of material as part of the rehabilitation process, and we preserve the existing exemption.
Great. Thank you. I want to thank all the members of the panel for your energy and effort on the bill, and ask you to stick around in case some questions come up as we go through the material.
Thank you.
All right. We will move on and ask Holly Pruitt and Vieta Helmley from the Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence to come up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Holly Pruitt, the Executive Director of the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, and this is Vieta Helmley, our Legislative Committee Chair. We would like to just present you with a very brief statement in support of House Bill 2681. The OCADSV is a statewide network of 31 community-based direct service programs that work with victims of domestic violence and sexual assault across the state. In acting favorably on a number of bills addressing child sexual abuse this session, this committee has already demonstrated leadership, and we thank you for that very sincerely, in acknowledging the epidemic and tragic nature of child sexual abuse in our society. And today, we applaud you for taking the further step of looking at the role of pornography in promoting this sexual abuse. We believe that for too long the debate over pornography has focused on definitions of obscenity and has altogether ignored the harm that pornography actually causes. Now, pornography harms those used in its manufacture, and it also harms those who are abused by the consumers of pornography. While it's clear to everyone, as has already been stated by previous witnesses, that the use of children in the manufacture of pornography is harmful and obviously criminal, many people are not aware that a high proportion of women, adult women, who are used in the manufacture of pornography are being similarly violated. From work with women in the sex industry in our crisis centers, we know that in many cases pornography provides an actual record of criminal acts of rape, torture, menacing, and in some cases murder. Our crisis centers and others around the country have worked with women who were used in the manufacture of pornography against their will. Now, once created, these records of their violation become protected by First Amendment interpretations, and those victimized by the manufacturer have essentially no recourse. But pornography wreaks havoc in far more lives than just its subjects. Our crisis centers also report numerous incidents of women and children being forced to replicate sexual acts depicted in pornography. As you've heard, in some instances, children are groomed to be obedient sexual participants through exposure to pornography. In other cases, women have been raped and tortured by men who quoted directly from pornographic material during the assault, or by men who viewed pornography during the course of the attack, expecting the victim to behave identically to the women portrayed. Now, I know that this isn't the direct intent of the bill, but we do want to call to your attention that by criminalizing the possession of child pornography, you are recognizing the harmful nature of that material. And we'd like you to encourage you in the future to consider that to stem the tide of sexual abuse throughout our society, that we have to go this next step and recognize pornography as a civil rights issue itself. I believe that if we had magazines depicting African-American men, just as one example, naked, bound, being tortured and loving it, that it would be clearly viewed as a civil rights violation. In conclusion, I believe that just as the connection was established between the white supremacist dogma of Tom Metzger and the racist murder of Mulugeta Seurat that was committed by other individuals, so too we need to understand the connection between the depiction of women and children as sexual abuse victims in pornography and the actual acts of sexual violence that occur daily. We must come to hold the constitutional rights of those used in and harmed by pornography as dear as the constitutional rights of those who consume, manufacture, and distribute it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your consideration.
Questions? Well, I appreciate you being here, Holly, and especially appreciate the connection that you helped draw for us between the balance between protecting constitutional rights on the one hand and the responsibilities that go along with that on the other. So appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm going to ask, for purposes of speeding the agenda, I'm going to ask three individuals whom I will refer to collectively as the authorities to come up. Mr. Lawson from the Customs Service, Major Renfro from the State Police, and Mr. Carosa, it looks like, from the U.S. Postal Inspector's Office, to come up together and sort of impose a little federalism on you here and ask you to speak to this bill for us. Identify yourself for the record, if you would, please, starting with Major Renfro.
Good afternoon, Chairman Clark, committee members. For the record, I'm Major Dean Renfro, Oregon State Police, Director of the Criminal Investigation Division. The department supports House Bill 2681. The state police have been heavily involved in the pursuit of individuals that sexually victimize children. We have participated in undercover operations with local and federal agencies and have observed a continuing stream of child pornography entering Oregon and in the possession of child molesters. These persons often contact one another through publications and then loan and exchange child pornography. The department has been involved in several investigations which undercover officers were introduced to child molesters by responding to advertisements in these publications. In one such case, the undercover officer, after communicating by mail with a child molester of a 4-year-old daughter of his girlfriend, was sent pornographic photographs of the child. Along with the photographs, the molester disclosed information describing his prowling and predatory behavior while looking for small children to sexually exploit. He mentioned stalking children at a shopping mall and at a fairgrounds. At that time, Oregon did not have a law which prohibited the dissemination of child pornography. He was arrested because of a child victim located in Wyoming, in which there is no statute of limitations of sexual crimes involving children. When arrested, this person had in his possession child pornography of his girlfriend's 4-year-old daughter.
Okay.
In another case,
Major,
an undercover officer...
Major Renfro, I'm going to interrupt you there and ask you to summarize the rest of your testimony for us. We've got just a number of witnesses that we need to get on and off, and appreciate your testimony and ask if you can summarize it for us.
Yes, Chairman. In another case, the same type of thing existed, and it's not uncommon for pedophiles to have a large collection of this child pornography in which they praise and value, and many times, many years beyond the child victim actually growing into adulthood, and they use this over and over again to relive the experiences that they had. This no doubt has a direct relationship into seeking out other child victims. Of course, the criminal statutes in Oregon do not adequately control this form of deviancy, and no Oregon law prohibits the possession. And for every person identified as having a need to possess child pornography, there are many more that are unidentified and many more victim children out there. And what we feel The prohibiting possession of child pornography would do is obviously identify the offenders, lead to sources of production and dissemination, identify previously unknown victims, and break the cycle of abuse and enhance the state's ability to protect children. It's a needed tool to protect our children. Under current law, obviously the possession of this material is lawful at this time. So that includes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Major. Mr. Lawson.
I probably wouldn't be able to add a whole lot more, and I'll be very brief. It seemed to me as we listened
and
to...
And Mr. Lawson, for the record, you are Marcus Lawson from the Customs Service?
U.S. Customs Service.
Great, thank you.
It seemed to me as I listened to the testimony earlier, the central issue before the committee is whether this particular statute is a child protection statute to which the state has a compelling interest dealing with the constitutional issues, as we know they will crop up. As someone who investigates child pornography cases in the last year, I'd say almost exclusively, I have met pedophiles undercover. I've corresponded with them. I have talked to them on the telephone. I've had a great deal of contact with them. And I can unequivocally state that, indeed, making the possession of child pornography illegal is a child protection statute. Pedophiles use the material to educate children, as we've heard. They use it to enhance their own, to get their own courage up, as it were, to bolster their courage to go out and seek children. They have told me in the past, and they've given me examples of cases where they've used pornography to educate children. I feel very strongly that this particular statute would be of great benefit to law enforcement.
Thank you very much, and we appreciate you being here today. Mr. Groza.
Yes, sir. My name is Paul Groza, Jr. I'm the United States Postal Inspector. Ladies and gentlemen, in the interest of brevity, I prepared a handout that's been provided. I might just say that I've been a postal inspector for over 17 years, and I've been investigating child pornography undercover for approximately 8 of those years. In my testimony that I provided, I summarized a few recent cases that may be of benefit to you that were prosecuted in the state of Oregon that involved sexual molestation of children as well as the mailing of child pornography. I would just like to summarize in this way. I support the bill, and my agency supports the bill. You know, I'm an investigator. I have personally observed the destructive nature of the child pornography. I've looked into the eyes of these children that I have interviewed. I've looked into the eyes of the pedophiles that I have arrested. And I can tell you that I have seen what child pornography does, what the photographs, what the films do. They are a cancer, and I mean a cancer. Through that photography, through possessing those items, there is absolutely no doubt that the pedophiles use it as part of their activity to seduce children, to molest children. Therefore, we support the bill wholeheartedly, and we believe that it is in the best interest of the citizens of the state of Oregon. I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Groza. I assume that the Postal Service sees a difference in the kind of activity that happens in states where possession is criminalized and those states where it is not.
I mean, I work in those states,
too, sir.
Different
states.
Yes, sir. My territory involves Oregon, Idaho, Utah, southern Washington, and northern Nevada. The states of Utah and Idaho, for example, do have possession statutes. And, in fact, I just recently convicted an individual for possession of child pornography in the state of Utah, who mailed that same child pornography to a fellow in Ashland, Oregon. It's one of the cases I cited versus Marquardt, U.S. versus Marquardt.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much. Question for members of the panel. Thank you. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
All right. Last witness on this bill is Patrick Grace, I think that's the right name, from the Oregon Library Association. Good afternoon, Mr. Grace. Welcome, and appreciate you being here. I look forward to your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Patrick Grace. I'm a librarian at Oregon State University, and I'm representing the Oregon Library Association. My statement, it was about two bills before you, so I'm just, it's a very brief statement. I'll just read you the part now about this Bill 2681. Librarians and librarians generally are in favor of free and open access to information and ideas, so I appreciate the opportunity to offer my opinion here today. While we are certainly all in agreement that the First Amendment is not meant to protect obscenity, there is always the concern that such legislation as the bill before us might fall hard on non-obscene, constitutionally protected materials. And we are concerned about the chilling effect, the possible chilling effect, that such laws might have on libraries. We are also concerned about this chilling effect it can have on publishers and book distributors. What affects them indirectly affects libraries' ability to carry out their mission. Any unclarity in the framing of the laws can give rise to resource-consuming litigation in the future. It is not my intention today to either endorse or condemn the bill, but I do have some comments on particular provisions regarding House Bill 2681. Although there is an exemption for educational activity, there is no exemption for libraries. It may be that protected literature, for example, sex education materials, could be interpreted as being prohibited, and any vagueness might cause unnecessary burdens on libraries. So I would recommend that libraries, acting in their legitimate educational function, be specifically exempted.
All right. Mr. Grace, let me ask you a question. Is it your view, then, that there might be things that do not fall within the three? Do you have a copy of the bill in front of you, first of all?
Pardon me?
You do have a copy of the bill in front of you?
Yes.
Okay. Section 3, subsections 1, 2, 3, or 4. Is it the view of the association that there might be materials in the possession of a library that do not fall within one of those three exceptions?
Well, by not specifically exempting libraries in their educational function, it's possible that the same thing that could be exempted for an educational institution would not then be exempted for a library.
All right. Further questions?
Yes.
Representative Mason.
What's a library?
Pardon?
What's a library?
What's a library?
How would you define a library, I think is the question.
Well, it depends. I mean, there's public libraries, academic libraries, corporate
libraries.
Pardon?
Are there any private libraries around?
Private libraries, well, a collection of books in your home would be a library.
Mm-hmm. Question.
I'm talking specifically, like educational libraries, like academic libraries, the library I work in, would be exempt under the statute.
Okay, let me interject here and ask counsel, do you know, counsel, is there a definition in the statutes? Are you ready to go?
There's language in 2669 in the current statute. In the current criminal code, it says it's an affirmative defense for the defendant to prove in other materials that there is such a thing called a bona fide public library, which I think would be the language that Representative Mason would be interested in. A bona fide public library at least would be, make it consistent with the criminal code.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Grace. We will take your concerns into account. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2681, move into work session on House Bill 2681. The chair would move a conceptual amendment and ask for counsel's guidance on it to add to the exceptions the public libraries statute that you mentioned, referred to a minute ago, and as a starting point. And I don't know if that's going to get all the way there.
Mr. Chairman?
Chair.
Representative Mannix.
The language that comes from current ORS 167085 allows for an affirmative defense for certain other statutes. We can incorporate it for this, that the defendant was a bona fide school, museum, or public library, or was acting in the course of employment as an employee of such organization or of a retail outlet affiliated with and serving the educational purpose of such organization.
Isn't that what I said?
Yes.
Okay, I thought that's what I said.
I like your version.
All right. Representative Mannix has amended the chair's motion, and without objection. Council has a question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, I guess the question I would have, though, is it your intent to only make the things that can be, that are included in 1, 2, and 3 of the printed bill to be things that a library can hold, or is it also things that might not be on that list that might come into the library's possession?
I didn't understand your question.
Is it the intent of your exception to be broader than subsections 1, 2, or 3 of Section 3?
1, 2, and 3 of Section 3 says that there are certain things that will fall outside this bill, material regarding medical procedures, I guess. Well, 1 and 2 are activities, and 3 are, I guess, goes to materials. The question is, the library's only going to have those things that otherwise people can have, or can they also have other things?
I would say they can only have those things that otherwise people can have.
Okay, that's the clarification I needed. Thank you.
All right, great. Further clarification on the amendment. Is there objection to the amendment to specifically accept libraries in that capacity? Hearing none, so ordered. Further motion. Representative Mannix.
I move House Bill 2681 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Mannix moves House Bill 2681 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion. Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bauman?
Aye.
Representative Bell?
Aye.
Representative Edmondson?
Aye.
Representative Mannix?
Aye.
Representative Mason?
Aye.
Representative Parks?
Representative Parks?
Aye.
Representative Sinceri?
Aye.
Chair Clark?
Chair votes aye. Bill is passed to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and we'll ask Representative Mannix to carry the bill.
Thank you.
And the chair might help out on the floor. All right. Close that work session on House Bill 2681. Open the work session on House Bill 2669. I'm sorry, open the public hearing on House Bill 2669. And again, I'm going to ask Representative Mannix to come to the witness table. For the benefit of the committee, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 sets of witnesses signed up on this bill. This bill is perhaps a bit more controversial. We have several folks signed up to testify in outright opposition, and so this one may take a little bit of attention. Representative Mannix, welcome.
Thank you, Mr.
again.
Chairman, members of the committee. I will mention I have with me Kathy LeCompte and Jeanette Gardner, and they will introduce themselves a little further and discuss this bill. I'm Representative Kevin Mannix, representing District 32, which is Central and Northeast Salem. I am going to take you through this bill because I will say bluntly that a great deal of the opposition to this bill has come from people who apparently have not read it. They've received transmissions and notices and warnings about the draconian situation that was about to occur in Salem, but they didn't read the bill. And I say that knowing full well that it's very hard for people to get their hands on draft legislation and bills, but I'm concerned because if rumor and misunderstanding becomes rampant, then misunderstanding within the legislature can occur too. I want to emphasize that there currently is a law on the books that makes it a crime to furnish obscene material to a minor. That law has been on the books for a long time. All that this bill does is draw from that law and say that if someone commits what would have been the crime of furnishing obscene materials to a minor, that a parent or legal guardian can bring civil action against the person who did that. Now, because we're talking about a civil action as opposed to criminal prosecution, there are some changes in terminology and concept. Well, what we did was, and I'll take you first to Section 3 of this bill, was we cleaned up, and I think Representative Edmondson later may have some further cleanup language, we cleaned up the law as it relates to the crime of furnishing obscene materials to minors. And we did this, and I've distributed to committee members a letter from Legislative Council. We did this to accommodate some indirect concerns expressed in a couple of Court of Appeals decisions regarding the terminology. And this was all done in the interest, first, of on the criminal law side, tightening up the law to make it meet constitutional standards. Then we shifted over to the civil side and said, okay, if you have effectively done this, you have furnished obscene material to a minor, we will allow a parent or legal guardian to bring civil action against you for doing that. Now, it is important to take a look at the definitions here in the criminal code part of this bill. The current law says that if you furnish, knowing or having good reason to know the character of the material furnished meets the following standards, any of this to a minor, you've committed a crime. Any picture, photograph, drawing, sculpture, motion picture, film, or other visual representation or image of a person or portion of the human body that depicts nudity, sadomasochistic abuse, sexual conduct, or sexual excitement. And then it lists books, magazines, paperbacks, and so forth. We've changed that terminology and tightened it up to, and again, Representative Edmondson is going to be proposing some language to tighten up the definition of what we're talking about in terms of what kind of nudity, but sexual excitement, sexually explicit conduct as defined in ORS 163665, sadistic abuse of a person or animal, or masochistic sexual activity. We've cleaned up the rest of the language in the criminal provision, and then we've created a civil cause of action. And these witnesses will discuss why we've created a civil cause of action. The civil cause of action is in Section 1. A parent or legal guardian can sue somebody, in effect. They have the burden of showing by a proposal.
Onto the Supreme Court and have reviewed sections of this chapter where these definitions have been used, and almost every time the specific areas were reviewed by the Supreme Court, they were found to be constitutionally unenforceable. And so it worries me a little bit if we're creating a civil area of law and using definitions from a statute where there's been considerable number of cases that have ruled some of the definitions or the use of the definitions in portions of the statutes as unconstitutional, that maybe the bill is starting out on the wrong foot from the beginning. Now then, it's my perspective that the 167.060 really muddies the legal landscape, and we got to remember here that we're dealing with Article 1, Section 8, which has its basic premise that all of this activity is permissible, and it's
Excuse
permissible.
Me. Mr. Garrett, let me stop you for just a minute and ask you a question that I've been kicking around since the beginning when Representative Maddox came up with the bill. Is the objection that you are presenting today an objection to House Bill 2669, or is it an objection to the existing statutory definition and criminal statute on obscenity? In other words, would it be, do you think that the existing obscenity statute would survive constitutional scrutiny under State versus Henry and its progeny? You see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I do.
Because the bill itself purports simply to take what is existing statute and add a private right of action to it.
Yes, it does.
And so if you're attacking the constitutionality of that, you must, it seems to me, be attacking the constitutionality of the underlying statute, which is current law.
And my concern is that if we're going to attach the definitions in 167060 to this bill, that a lot of that language has already been kicked around the Supreme Court, Mr. Chairman, and I think that the bill could be written without that language and avoid the muddy water that's already in that statute. I'm opposed to House Bill 2669, but I'm trying to make the point that I believe that it's an error procedurally here to.
Okay. Thank you. We got a number of questions here. I'm going to start with Representative Maddox and then go to Representative Mason and then Edmondson.
Well, I saw two other people jump at the constitutional issue, and I'll just mention as an aside that the Supreme Court of the United States and I think the Supreme Court of Oregon is going to note will recognize that one can define obscenity more broadly when one is dealing with obscenity distributed to children. I'll mention the New York versus Ferber case, which recognizes that the definition of obscenity in terms of furnishing it to children does not have to be as tight as the definition of obscenity in terms of adult activity. That's one case that I would mention. I'd also back up, and Mr. Hughes, your comment about the fear of having all kinds of civil actions filed. I tried to address that in my opening remarks, that there's a nice balance here because if people are crazy enough to sue, whoever has to defend is going to get attorney fees in response to that. It provides a very nice protective device that people should not be just skipping gaily into court thinking that they're going to give someone else a hard time. With that, I'll pause and just give you that information. And since we're going to have a further work session, I hope to have you chew on that, then I'll pass it on to the rest of the folks.
Right. And I would ask, before I go on to Representative Mason, Representative Evanson, I would ask Mr. Garrett and Mr. Hughes, at some point, if you can, either on your own or in concert with some of the other individuals who are concerned about the legislation, I think most of the members on the committee are lawyers, and those that aren't are smarter than those that are, and we would very much like to ask you for at least a short legal analysis setting out some of the constitutional points that you've raised, recognizing you couldn't do that between yesterday and today. So, Representative Evanson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Did I elevate you over? Representative Mason,
to,
I'm sorry. Vice Chair Mason and then Representative Evanson.
First of all, I want to compliment you for coming up. We don't get a lot of Los Angeles lawyers in front of our committee. This is kind of the hinterland. And
Representative Mason, I'm from Salem.
Oh, from Salem. Okay.
In that case, he has no questions for you.
Salem, okay.
I'm not sure, Mr. Where
did I get a Los Angeles lawyer?
All these like movie people.
Anyway, we ask you someone along the same line. We allow a civil cause of action for slander, don't we?
You bet.
No criminal thing. We allow a civil cause of action for libel. We allow a civil cause of action for outrageous conduct, right? And if I called you up and said, Mr. Garrett, your mother just died, and you go into some type of incredible impact upon you. There's no speech issue there, isn't that right?
If I may respond, I will agree that there are several private causes of action that are also covered in the criminal statutes.
Yeah. But I was going to say, it seems to me that you are missing the point, and you certainly may respond, missing the point of the bill is that Representative Maddox merely taken a definition out of a criminal statute and said that this is a civil cause of action. I think the fancy word is gravamen. Is that the word, right? Gravamen of which is the impact and the injury to the child. In other words, the exposure of the child to the obscene material is a tort against the child, and the instrument of the tort is the outrageous material. It has nothing to do with criminal law.
And I agree with you. And I submit to you that that cause of action exists today without the necessity of this bill. The tort exists. I think if indeed there is an abuse of Article 1, Section 8, that can be brought on the civil side without the necessity of House Bill 2669. That tort exists.
If I can, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mason, continue.
Well, then if the tort exists, then the tort's constitutional and the bill merely reflects the tort, how can the bill be unconstitutional?
Well, what I'm suggesting to you is that the language, the tort, a common law tort, doesn't necessarily carry with it the baggage of some definitional wording that's in the statute that the Supreme Court's already reviewed. This isn't necessary, in my view, to have a common law cause of action, as you just described.
Final question.
President Mason.
So if we were just to say, pull out the criminal definition and just say obscene material, then it would pass constitutional muster?
No, I'm not saying that that's the case either. I can't define obscene material.
What if we said outrageous material depicting some type of sexual conduct? Get into the common law tort. Merely codify the common law tort.
I'm not sure, Representative Mason, that I'm able to define it.
We got us a genuine constitutional stem winder. Representative Edmondson.
Mr. Garrett, I'm sympathetic to the short notice you had here, but your testimony isn't helpful at all.
I'm sorry.
You have accused the bill of muddying the water, and frankly, you've just dumped more silt into it. I want to know what definition, and you may want to respond in writing. I appreciate that, because in all fairness to you, and to the committee members, and I'm not being flip, this is a very serious matter, and I have great reservations about this bill. However, as it stands right now with minor modification, I'm prepared to vote for it, argue for it, and support it back to the voters in my district. I am concerned, however, about the term nudity, notwithstanding the fact that my staff just gave me a copy of one of the most recent issues of Sports Illustrated, and I am afraid that it probably exceeds the standards of Playboy magazine in the 1960s. So I am concerned about the term nudity, and I believe that we should, so far as it is current law, that it's a crime to display nudity, which I think probably makes Sports Illustrated a crime to sell it to minors in the state, at least that division, that we should say nudity for the purpose of titillation. Because that nudity in and of itself, I mean, there's all kinds of artistic expression arguments that we need not go into. But other than that, I've been looking at these definitions and wondering what in the world you're talking about. Now, do you want to respond now, or would you like to do that in writing?
I would like to do that in writing, Representative Edmonds.
And just so the committee knows, we have one more bill that is important to a number of people here, as well as the chair, that we need to get to. So I want to move through this, recognize the importance of it. Also recognize the importance that we will return to it. This is not an issue that we're going to be able to clarify today. Representative Bell.
I guess I'm a little astounded at your hesitancy to do something in your industry to protect children. And in the alcohol beverage industry, we even hold bartenders accountable, even though it's not illegal to sell beer or liquor. They have accepted some accountability for selling too much to an individual, and we've imposed that upon them. And I guess that's what we're trying to do here. And I would think you'd welcome something that would put a cap on it, because surely, as a parent, I have every right in the world to sue somebody that damages my child. This is simply putting it in a context by which it tells me what my limits are. And trying to define it so that it isn't at the whim of any customer. Because if it is at the whim, they may well pay for their little activity. But by putting a cap on it, having it in the law, we come to an understanding of what your responsibilities are and what my limitations are as to, you know, how I can respond to you. But surely, from a constitutional standpoint, I have the right to sue any retailer who damages my child by selling the material that's harmful to them, don't I?
I think you have that right today.
Okay. All right. I'm going to cut it off here. Thank you, Mr. Hughes, and you, Mr. Garrett, and again ask you to provide us with some written commentary, further commentary and analysis of the bill, because I think you get the sense that the committee is both very interested in the bill and also takes very seriously our obligation to the Oregon Constitution.
I do get that sense, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hughes, Mr. Garrett. I'm going to ask, let's see. I'm going to make sure we don't miss anybody. And looks like Thomas Hull, Jim Ledwick, Richard Rice from the Video Software Dealers Association to come up. We appreciate your patience in waiting to testify and ask for your comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and representatives of the committee, and we appreciate the opportunity to testify. My name is Thomas Hull, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I own and operate a video store a few blocks from my home. I'm also the vice president of the Oregon and Southwest Washington chapter of the Video Software Dealers Association, which is an international trade organization. As Vice President of the Board of Directors of the Oregon Southwest chapter, I'm compelled to testify against House Bill 2669. This proposed legislation, I believe, is unreasonable, unfair, unnecessary, and probably unconstitutional. I believe it will prove to be costly to all Oregonians, choking our judicial system while impinging our freedom of choice and expression. House Bill 2669 will create undue risk of civil liability and punitive damages for any person in the video industry found to have provided obscene material to a minor based on an extremely broad definition of obscenity. As defined in this bill, obscene material would include many popular movies that families watch at theaters, on primetime television, cable television, and by satellite television. A retailer selling or renting the same films would be subject to suit. Sound business practice already constrains video retailers from providing obscene materials to minors, as does the law. The video industry has been responsibly self-regulated since its inception by voluntarily abiding by the Motion Picture Association of America's rating systems, just as movie theaters do. Unlike movie theaters and television, however, video stores are community-based. We are extremely market-oriented, and we are dependent upon repeat business. No one can hope to survive in today's demanding and discerning marketplace by running the risk of offending customers or our customers' parents. Therefore, we won't, and we don't. By their very nature as community-based enterprises, video stores meet and, in fact, help to establish the community standards by which the U.S. Supreme Court currently measures what constitutes obscenity. Our industry is ever vigilant in these matters, as witnessed by our pledge to parents, which I can provide copies of to all the members. This is an ongoing nationwide and industry-wide effort to educate our customers of our voluntarily self-imposed standards by which minors may acquire goods and services from us. No one had to tell us to undertake this. We do it because it's right, it's what our customers want, and it is simply good business sense. Our pledge to parents states that we will not provide videotapes to minors without prior parental consent. If the videotape is rated R or NC-17 by the MPAA, or if in the judgment of the store, the content of the tape is unsuitable for minors, as in the case of some unrated videos. A lot of films are released unrated.
May I inquire on that point?
Representative Maddox.
So if we add in a provision that if there's a signed parental consent, if we put that exception in here, that would take care of your current practice, wouldn't it?
That would cover the current practice, as I understand it, Representative Maddox, yeah, as I understand the question.
Okay, thank you.
The pledge puts the onus on parents where it properly belongs, while assuring parents that their concerns will be met in their absence. To do otherwise would be commercial suicide for anyone in the video business. House Bill 2669 constitutes unwarranted and unnecessary governmental intervention in a self-regulating, responsible, and extremely market-sensitive industry. If it becomes law, this bill will become a costly burden for the taxpayers of Oregon as they sue one another, and as they sue the state itself, seeking constitutional redress in the federal courts. It will unduly constrain Oregonians' freedom of choice and expression while creating a less diverse and livable climate for all who choose to call Oregon home. And if I may, I'd like to add, in response to Representative Maddox's earlier comment about the balance of having the award of attorney's fees, I can tell you that as a small business person, one lawsuit, I'm out of business. Doesn't matter who prevails, I will not be able to survive. This is a business that is run on very, very narrow margins. It is primarily a business, 90% of it approximately, is a business that is family-owned, family-operated, single-store operators. We are not in a position to defend ourselves against the possibility of the frivolous suits and actions that could result from this bill.
May I inquire?
Thank you very much.
Quickly.
Briefly, please.
But a parental consent provision, if we said that for a video rental outlet, that if they had a parental consent provision and parents had signed and that you're out of there, that would take care of you, wouldn't it?
That would be a great help, and I believe it would take care of us, Representative Maddox. And part of the pledge to parents, which I will also provide to you, is a sample parental consent form. Most video stores that I know of, certainly mine, We always ask the parents when they sign up. We will not sign up minors. We will not allow minors to rent without parental consent anything.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you're obviously a very scrupulous dealer, and I think that if we can use that as a pattern for some others out there, that that will help a lot. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Rice and Mr. Ludwig, either one.
My name is Jim Ludwig. I live in southeast Portland. I operate a video rental business in the greater Portland area. Mr. Chairman and committee members, thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak with you today. First, it appears that the sponsors of this measure and those who have spoken in support of it share many concerns that I have. I have two very young children. I think about what they're exposed to practically daily. I worry about some of the problems that we have in our society. However, I do oppose this bill for a variety of reasons. Let me mention that in my video store, we do not stock any X-rated movies. Yet I still feel threatened. And by the way, I do have, I don't want to forget to mention, I do have prepared written testimony.
Could you also pass up a copy of that consent form that you were talking about?
If you'd like, I have copies for everyone.
Oh, that'd be great. Thank you.
The primary point that I would like to make to you today is that even though there are existing criminal obscenity laws, this bill opens the door too broadly, I believe, for civil action. Anyone can bring an action. It creates undue risk and exposure to specific segments of the retail community. And I want to repeat that because I think that's the key thing. It does create an undue risk and exposure. Under the Motion Picture Association's rating system, many popular mainstream motion pictures, including virtually all R-rated films, many PG-13 rated, and even some PG-rated films, could be considered obscene by any individual if this bill becomes law. In fact, earlier testimony this afternoon by some of the supporters of the bill indicate to me an eagerness to sue. And I think that's a significant point. One person or group could effectively harass me and my business. I would face the expense of legal defense. We've addressed that, but I'd like to point out that even if I prevail in court, that does not necessarily mean that the plaintiff who brought the action would be able to pay my attorney's fees. My time would be taken away from my business, and probably most damaging, there could be widespread negative publicity about my business and about me personally that could be irreparable. To guard against this exposure, I could purge my inventory of thousands of movies, leaving only the children's and what are commonly called family films available for rental. However, really, the loser in this scenario would be the hundreds of thousands of citizens who want access to these films. Finally, I just want to add something to what Mr. Hull's comments were a moment ago about the pledge to parents, which I think you'll be receiving copies of. I just want to point out that that is a new nationwide effort to address this very issue. There is one trade association representing the video industry, Video Software Dealers Association. It recognizes the problem. This is certainly not the only state where this issue has been raised, and we are addressing it. We are self-policing, in addition to the fact that the majority, the vast majority of video store owners and operators are very concerned, and they don't want angry parents coming back at them. It's poor business practice. We do regulate ourselves. I won't say it's 100%. Of course, there are bad apples. But the industry is very young. It's gone through tremendous growth, as you know, and it is self-policing and self-regulating. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Rice.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Richard Price. I work for a wholesale distributor of video and audio in Portland, and while we have a company policy of not distributing any X-rated material, the language of this bill defines obscenity so broadly that our customers, the retailers, might hesitate to buy many mainstream movies that can be seen in theaters or watched on primetime TV. The motion picture business is self-regulated with the MPAA rating system. The video industry, as Mr. Hull and Mr. Lodwig have mentioned, has begun a self-regulating campaign. Therefore, the legislation seems to me to be unnecessary.
Thank you very much. Questions for these three witnesses? Representative Bell.
I'm really confused when you talk about the legislation is unnecessary, because if we don't change anything, the law is still there. The very same definitions that you are contesting are still there. And you could still be sued for the very same thing. I don't understand why you want us to do nothing.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Bell. Unless you're suggesting we take something out of the statute.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bell, I would say that that's the reason it's unnecessary. It's redundant. It already exists on the books. We're already well-regulated by ourselves and by law, by statute. I'm not an attorney. I don't know the statutes, but that is my understanding. I certainly... I'm not going to rent anything that I would construe as being obscene to a minor. I wouldn't rent anything that I consider to be obscene to someone who's not a minor. I would not open myself to that risk, is I guess what I'm saying.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bell.
Do you see the point I'm making, though, that all we're asking to do is to put the definition as far as what a parent can do and the limit to what they can do? Because without that, you're really left wide open. It seems to me that this bill is to your advantage, especially based on the care you're taking to live within the already established law.
Representative Bell, let me try and redirect maybe what your concern is, and it's a question that's come up before, whether the concern about the bill is a concern about the bill or about the existing definitions that are written in the criminal statutes. I think you probably heard the discussion that we had earlier. And I don't know if you want to try and answer that now or if you want to.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bell, I wouldn't attempt to answer that question now, no.
All right, thank you very much. Gentlemen, I want to thank you. I own and operate a small business with my sister, and I appreciate the time that you've taken out of your business today. I know it's not an easy thing to get an entire afternoon off to come sit in the legislature and testify, but we appreciate it, and we really need your testimony on issues like this. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Duke Lee, Mr. Jeff Lilly, it looks like, and Mr. Patrick Grace. I'm going to ask you to all come up at the same time in the interest of time. And we'll start with Mr. Grace and then go to Mr. Lee and Mr. Lilly and ask you to identify yourself for the record and your association or affiliation, if any.
I'm Patrick Grace. I'm representing the Oregon Library Association. And my statement now is just a continuation of what I had started before. And regarding House Bill 2669, this bill does have an exemption, or rather a defense, for libraries in the performance of their educational function. However, some of the definitions of obscene materials may be broad enough so as to include artistic or educational literature. As a result, one of two things could happen. Either the libraries themselves could be challenged for going beyond their scope, or publishers and book distributors could be so intimidated by the broad statutory language that they not publish or distribute constitutionally protected literature. In either case, this could lead to costly litigation and the blocking of libraries' ability to carry out their mission. Now, the point of what I'm trying to say today is that such legislation, if not tightly drafted, produces a long-lasting fallout. And I'm speaking from one of the areas that has borne a great burden from that fallout, namely libraries. And we will follow the development of these bills with keen interest, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Grace. Appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, can I just ask a question?
Representative Sasseri.
When is a library going to have sexually explicit material?
Sex education? I mean, sexually explicit, there are, I'm not sure, you know, some of the definitions in there are about sexually explicit materials libraries will never have.
Or sexual conduct.
That's some of those about the definition of obscene materials. There are library materials about sex education that that have that depict nudity.
Well, I don't think that this bill addresses that specifically. I think it talks about conduct.
It mentions nudity in as one of it mentions nudity in the bill.
Okay.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Lee. Mr. Lee.
Good afternoon, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Duke Lee, and I am an employee of a record retailer in Portland, and actually it's Tower Records, and that's an international wide chain. And we're a member of NARM, which is an acronym for National Association of Recording Merchandisers, and I'm acting upon their alerting us of this proposed bill. You'll excuse me if I'm a little nervous. This is the first time I've ever done anything like this.
That's fine. If you're lucky, it will be the last, right?
Yeah, please. My point today is after I reviewed this and heard testimonies left and right, and your point of view from Representative Bell, who has contributed to this proposal, Representative Mannix. And I understand both sides real clear, but what isn't clear to me is like where, what do you define obscene, and where do you draw the line? It's not so much this proposed bill that's coming up here right now, but I mean maybe we should establish what's obscene first before we propose another bill, you know, an amendment to it, you know, for a parent to take legal actions against a retailer. You know, I mean, I'm speaking out not only as a as an employee of a retail chain, because I'm not in fear of myself for being sued by a parent for selling a minor an obscene tape or CD. You know, I'm also concerned as a citizen that you know how far is this thing going to go. You know, an amendment passed. What else is going to be amended to that? That's my point. And the thing that gets me the most is that child rearing should be done with the family. If you're going to involve a record retailer by, you know, accusing him of selling, I mean, don't you think that you should raise your child the way, you raise your child correctly? You know, if you know what's right and what's wrong, sit down with your child. Talk to him. He knows what's right. He knows what's wrong. If he picks up something that's obscene, of obscene lyric, or of pornography or something, and you one day discover he's hidden it underneath his mattress, don't you think you should sit down as a family unit and talk to him about what is right and what's wrong? I mean, I can't speak for Representative Bell, who has children, because I.